Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Warner v. Coldwell.
The court originally issued a per curiam opinion in this cause. The court reversed as to I.M. Warner trustee, but she was not a party in the trial court. The court affirmed as to Eastex and Carlo Warner without discussion. Carlo Warner and Eastex filed a motion for rehearing, which was granted. The court granted points of error 1 and 2 in the rehearing, which was remained to points of error 3, 4, 5, and 6 in the application. The court also withdrew the per curiam opinion and dismissed Coldwell's motion for rehearing as moot. I understand that the whole case is before the court, but just want to reiterate that although the court didn't grant the points of error 1 and 2, that I and Warner still request relief from this court. Now I'll discuss the granted points.
Do you quarrel with anything that was written in the per curiam that was in the form?
No, Your Honor, you don't.
Except I take it to the extent that a per curiam opinion, which doesn't refer to other any other grounds, essentially is an affirmance of the Court of Appeals on those points.
I guess I don't understand your question.
Well, that's kind of an inside debate.
I think we understand your position. Anything that's written, we were right as far as we went, but your position is the court should have reversed to the other on the other.
You're right. I should have clarified that just a moment ago. I asked your question. Our position is that it should also reverse as to Carlo Warner and to Eastex.
Which is what you're going to argue now.
Exactly. Those two issues are whether Carlo Warner is individually liable as a fellow employee or supervisor of Coldwell, and the second issue is whether there's some evidence of the negligence of Eastex. Carlo Warner individually was not liable as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals erred in finding that Carlo Warner was liable as Eastex's employer. The Court of Appeals also erred in failing to address Carlo Warner's argument that as a matter of law he's not liable. The Court of Appeals treated Carlo Warner as if he were Coldwell's employer. The Court of Appeals stated, quote, Eastex and Carlo had a duty to furnish a reasonably safe workplace and an adequate workforce, unquote. A fellow employee or supervisor doesn't have any such individual duty. The reason is that a mere employee or supervisor doesn't have control over those kinds of issues in the workplace. A fellow employee or supervisor owes a duty of ordinary and reasonable care to a fellow employee. As a matter of law, Carlo Warner did not breach any duty that he owed to Coldwell. Coldwell claims that Carlo Warner was negligent in not being at work. Her argument is basically that if Carlo Warner had been at work that day, he would have been doing the lifting that she did whenever she was injured.
He was too drunk to lift anything, wasn't he?
He was intoxicated and taken home that morning, yes, Your Honor. No Texas case has ever held an employee or a supervisor liable in negligence to a fellow employee for being absent from the workplace.
I want to try to understand the background on this. Is Eastex owned by Carlo Warner and I.M. Warner?
They are shareholders of Eastex Corporation, yes. And it has been conceded at this point in the case that they're not trying to hold him liable in his position as an owner. It's his position as a worker. There was no attempt to pierce the corporate veil and no alter ego theory. So it's irrelevant for this discussion that he actually owned the company also. As a matter of law, an employee can't be individually liable for being absent from the workplace. The cases cited by Coldwell don't support a position against Carlo Warner individually as a fellow employee or as a supervisor. All of those cases hold the employer liable for the negligence of the fellow employee or the supervisor under the doctrine of respondeat superior. This is because the fellow employee or supervisor, as the employer's agent, was negligent in fulfilling the duties that the employer owed to the employee. Because there's no evidence that Carlo Warner individually breached any duty that he owed to Coldwell, this court should reverse as to him. Also, there was no evidence that Eastex was negligent. Because Eastex was a non-subscriber, Coldwell must establish that Eastex was negligent in order to recover. The evidence at trial, considered in the light most favorable to Coldwell, is as follows. Coldwell worked at Eastex as a meat wrapper. Her job consisted of wrapping, packing, and loading meat. The evidence showed that Carlo Warner had been drinking at Eastex on the morning of October 8th and that I.M. Warner left to take him home. Colwell injured her back that morning while lifting a bag of meat weighing about 60 pounds onto a customer's pickup truck. The evidence also showed that Carlo Werner or another male employee usually did the lifting and loading meat onto customers' vehicles at East Tex. Also, if Carlo Werner had been there that day, he would have been the one that probably would have done this lifting. The evidence also showed that on prior occasions, however, when Carlo was absent, that either Colwell or another employee would do the lifting and loading the meat into customers' vehicles. Also, another employee, Lily Hunter, was working at East Tex that morning whenever Colwell was injured. Both Lily Hunter and Colwell that morning had loaded meat onto customers' vehicles without incident. These facts simply do not establish a breach of any duty by East Tex. There was no evidence that East Tex was negligent in allowing Colwell and Lily Hunter, two meat wrappers, to lift the 60-pound bag of meat onto a customer's vehicle. There was simply no evidence offered that two workers constituted an adequate workforce to perform these duties. And there was absolutely no evidence, expert or otherwise, offered of anything that East Tex should have done differently. Further, East Tex couldn't have reasonably foreseen Colwell's injuries. This court's decision in Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company versus Evans is on point. In that case, Evans worked as a stock boy at A&P. Part of his job included moving 100-pound sacks of potatoes. He did this on a regular basis as part of his job. He had to move them about 70 or 80 feet from the front of the store to the back of the store. He did this regularly. He did it without complaint, and he did it without incident. One day, however, Evans became injured. He suffered a hernia. The trial court found that A&P was negligent. Court of Appeals affirmed. This court held as a matter of law the injury was not foreseeable. This court concluded that lifting potato sacks such as this was part of the usual and customary work of a job like that. The same is true in this case. Part of the usual and customary work of a meat wrapper is going to be lifting and moving meat. This is something that had been done at East Tex by all the employees for a period of time on a regular basis, again without incident, and again without complaint. As a matter of law, East Tex could not have reasonably foreseen Colwell's injury. It should also be noted that Colwell, at no point in this appeal, has ever addressed this court's decision in A&P versus Evans. That decision is controlling, and this court should also reverse as to East Tex.
Mr. Harris, I don't really understand the interrelationship between the award based on the employee benefit plan and the negligence judgment. Are you contending that due to the absence of evidence of negligence that there is no recovery under the employee benefit plan, or are those alternatives?
There are alternative theories of recovery. Whenever I am one or trustee is removed from the lawsuit, so if this court reverses as to her, any benefits that, that would have been awarded under the plan would also have been removed because they didn't sue the proper part. They should have sued I.M. Werner trustee, which in fact they had done in another lawsuit. During the trial of this case, when they realized they hadn't sued the trustee, they filed a second lawsuit and served Mr. Werner during trial. That wasn't made part of the original record on appeal. The petition from that lawsuit, however, was filed with the Court of Appeals with a motion to take judicial notice, and the Court of Appeals did take judicial notice of the second lawsuit, and I believe that's also attached as Appendix A to my application.
When an employer chooses not to buy workers' compensation insurance, but to offer a employee benefit plan, more or less, in lieu of thereof, is this, this is not, let me ask, this is an additional benefit that they're seeking? In other words, the $298,000 judgment or thereabouts for negligence, is the $250,000 judgment against the plan a credit toward that $298,000?
Typically, yes. Under this judgment, no. Before I was involved in the case, that was not an issue that had been preserved. It was an issue that was raised in the Court of Appeals that the judgment allows a double recovery. Under the judgment in this case, they can recover the $250,000 benefits under the plan and then go execute on the $298,000 portion of the judgment also. That's not an issue before this court, but error wasn't preserved below.
I was just trying to understand the interrelationship.
Yes, typically they would be alternative. You could sue for one or the other and then elect remedies, whichever the plaintiff wanted to elect. So they would be alternative theories of recovery. In conclusion,
what's the status of that case, second case?
The second case, I believe, has been removed to federal court and is stayed pending disposition of this case by this court. Please, the current status of that, although I'm not counsel in that case. Petitioners pray that this court reverse the judgments of the Court of Appeals and Trial Court and render judgment in Caldwell County.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please report, Ms. Amy Thomas will be the argument for respondent.
May it please the court. As Justice Corin was just asking, there are two theories that the judgment awarded liability on. The first theory was the negligence theory against E6, the employer, negligence theory against Carlo Warner. The other portion of the judgment was for benefits that were due Dixie Caldwell under essentially a contract to provide insurance benefits.
Is Ms. Caldwell a signatory to this employee benefit plan, or?
No, in part of the record, there's the employment agreement, and part of it was that they were to provide workers' comp benefits. They elected out of the system, but that, it's my position that she's a third-party beneficiary to that contract. That's what Eastex set that plan up, was for the benefit of any employees who were injured on the job.
And generally, is the reason an employer buys a plan like this in lieu of workers' compensation insurance because workers' comp is more expensive?
I believe that's what they're trying to do, but the fact is that they don't buy insurance. It does comply with what is required under Texas law to meet the requirements of comp. They have opted out of the system, and the fact that they have acquired a substitute policy that doesn't meet the requirements the legislature has imposed to be a comp policy doesn't save them, and it doesn't mean this is double recovery. It's akin to having first-party insurance, but she received an injury, she's got those medical benefits due, and she's also able to sue against the negligent person who caused those injuries.
So the fact they don't carry comp insurance waives all their common law defenses, required your client to prove negligence, but you're saying they can recover under a negligence theory and under a third-party beneficiary theory.
There's really separate harms. Her harm on recovering the benefits is that she's met the requirements. She's disabled. There's expert testimony on that. She received an on-the-job injury, and therefore the harm is not complying with the contract. So if you meet all these requirements, we're going to pay you your weekly, your 66% of your weekly rate. And just on that, I mean, it's amazing when you read the record. The defense counsel who tried this, his opening statement says, part of what we're going to have to prove and part of the question is to see if she's even entitled to benefits is, did she have an on-the-job injury? And if she has an on-the-job injury, what's the extent of it? The jury answered those only disputed questions.
The petitioner's position is that you can't recover benefits because the trustee was not named in the suit, and that's what's going on in the second suit. Do you agree with that?
Well, no. This argument arose during the trial, and we had a statute of limitations about to run, and you don't want to get up here and get reversed and then can't go back and sue the right party because your statute of limitations. That was only done to prepare to, in the inevitable event that this court reversed. I don't think it's any type of estoppel on our part. That is an entity.
You mean in the unlikely.
The unlikely is in this court reverse. But
do you agree that you're seeking to hold Mr. Warner liable as a fellow employee and not as the employee?
We're seeking to hold Mr. Warner liable as an individual who owed the duty to exercise reasonable care.
As a fellow employee.
As a fellow employee, as any of us are required to do under the law. They try to talk about the misfeasance, the nonfeasance, and the law is clear, and they want to say, this is going to mean that employees are going to be held liable when they're absent from work. And that's an oversimplification of the record. Carlo Warner was at work that day. He was the supervisor. He was a manager. He did have control over those abilities. He decided instead of staying there and supervising those trusted his care that he was just going to get drunk and leave work. And the law is clear, and it's an old Supreme Court case. Misfeasance involves to some extent the idea of not doing. as where an agent, while not engaged in the performance of his undertaking, does not do something that was his duty to perform under the circumstances, doesn't take precautions, doesn't exercise that care which a due regard for others requires. And a recent case out of San Antonio that was just handed down in September of 94, Leitch, Cruz, Procan versus Hornsby, they said, let me give you the modern interpretation of that. And that case held the employer and two co-workers negligence. He said, he cannot, by leaving things in a dangerous condition, exempt himself from liability for one injured because he so left them.
If East Texas had carried workers' compensation insurance, can you sue a co-worker or a supervisor for negligence?
I think that you would still have your ability to sue the co-worker, right?
For negligence?
Well, no, I guess I'm just wrong. So the employer, probably not. I think that would be a common law defense.
So the reason you can sue the co-worker here is because they didn't carry comp, and so you have your common law right of action against East Texas and any co-worker?
That's correct. Okay. Well, what I'm going to say is if it's just like a truck driver, and he's driving down the road, and if he's negligent, just because of the fact that he was in the course and scope of his employment, does not save him from the negligence and liability to these third parties. These third parties who are the victim of his negligent act, he was drunk while he was driving the truck, they've got a right to sue the company he was working for, and they've got a right to sue him. So I don't think the fact that he removed himself from the workplace and that his physical presence wasn't there is something that's going to save Carlo Warner from liability. And then going back to the East Tech's negligence, if they challenge the factual sufficiency of the jury finding that East Tech was negligent. And I think for this court to reverse that portion of the judgment, it would have to rewrite a huge body of law on jurisprudence of the state. The law is clear that employers have a duty to provide a safe workplace. That's the big duty, and encompassed in that is you've got to find adequate crew, you've got to give them tools to do it safely, you got to make sure they're supervised, you got to give them instructions. All of those things did not happen in this case.
What's the evidence of foreseeability?
Foreseeability?
I mean, you have to instruct on how to lift a piece of meat.
Well, in this case, it's foreseeable that if you have two people who are doing a job that they were not hired to do and they were not trained to do, that they do not receive instructions on how to do it safely, the person who's supervising removes themselves and they're just left there to do it on their own. I think it's a foreseeable injury that these employees aren't going to know the job and get themselves hurt.
Is that an inadequate or is that an incompetent workforce?
That's an inadequate workforce in that the two people were left. It was meant to be a three-person job. That part of the puzzle was gone when he left. It's an incompetent workforce and the fact that they had an incompetent drunk supervisor out there supposed to be doing his job and decided he'd rather drink and testified he was glad to get the time off. So I think that there's lots of elements that show that there was negligence on the part of East Tech. In that respect, one of the cases that they cite to show that, well, maybe he was negligent, but it shouldn't impose liability on him. It imposes liability on the employer. It's the fact that there's a supervisor who's supposed to go and help this person move a heavy motor. He doesn't go. Now, they say that means the supervisor can't be held liable for his act. And they specifically argue...
Based on the last case, at least at the time of this action, shouldn't we be referring to him as disabled or handicapped?
Part two, Mr. Warner?
Yeah.
They didn't raise that as a standard. I think that would be a common law defense. They would be stripped of. This is from their rehearing. One of the cases cited by Caldwell, Loud versus Sears and Robeck, is the best illustration of the distinction between the duties of the employer and a fellow employee supervisor. In that case, the worker was injured when his supervisor failed to show up to lift the motor. They said there the court held that the supervisor as agent of the employer would be individually liable to the worker only for his own misfeasance and positive wrongs, not for nonfeasance. And they take this case and say Carlo Warner is not individually liable for being absent from work at alleged nonfeasance or omission of duty. Carlo Warner did not commit any misfeasance, which I disagree with. But any liability for his nonfeasance, that being he wasn't there to help out doing the job, would be imputed to the employer. There is plenty of evidence that Carlo Warner was negligent that day, and his negligence should be imputed to the employer. And therefore, the finding by the jury that East Tech was negligent and the answer to yes is supported by the, amply supported by the record. I think the fact that these women had done lifting before doesn't remove it from being foreseeable. And the record also states that when they did do the lifting, they were helping other people out. There's nothing in the record that these women were ever left to step in and do somebody else's job and do it repetitiously and time again. And we're not talking about lifting a 60-pound bag of meat. We're talking about picking that 60-pound bag of meat up over and over and over again. There was testimony that there was over 800 pounds lifted that morning. And there's expert testimony that back injuries are common from lifting. And the Weingarter case said it's common knowledge that when you have an excess strain, that it's foreseeable that there's going to be a back injury. And those cases are cited in my brief.
Now, I gather you do, based on your question, you disagree with what we put out in the per curiam, based on your brief. What you put out, what we said in the per curiam, that we would not.
I disagree mainly, and if you look at the handout that's before you, if this is what we were just suing for. The defense counsel knew his opening statements, he refers to our burden of proof to get the benefits under the plan. Motion in limine, he talks about, well, if they get a favorable finding, that this plan will kick in. All through the testimony, in fact, the defense counsel is the one bringing it in through his direct as to what her weekly wages were, what the rate of comp would be. Obviously, it was tried by, this was an issue before the court. They never objected to the capacity issue. I think what's clear is this is not a separate entity that's not before the court. The East Texas plan is not some legal entity that exists out there, such that they were not a party before the court. That is akin to an attorney setting up a trust account. I mean, if Daryl Jordan had taken that $250,000 fee and put it in a trust account, had an agreement where he set forth, I'm going to put it here, Daryl Jordan's law firm is going to put this $250,000 here, Daryl Jordan's going to be trustee, and I'm going to bill against it, and then the remainder is going to be owed to the client. And when the client comes to get her remainder, she doesn't sue Daryl Jordan's client trust fund. Is that going to be a party that needed to be named before the court? No. We've got the pleadings. We've got the pleadings naming East Tech Meat Processing Company. We got the pleadings naming I.M. Warner. I mean, there was clearly argued that there was two theories before the court. And I.M. Warner was before the court to defend the allegations that Dixie Caldwell was not due the benefits under the plan. And there's case law, the Pledger case, this court wrote in 1988, says when capacity is contested, Rule 93.2 requires that a verified plea be filed any time that the record does not affirmatively demonstrate the plaintiff or defendant's right to bring suit or be sued in whatever capacity he is suing. Its application is not limited to cases of representative capacity only. I mean, clearly, she was before the court. East Tech Meat Processing was before the court. The defense counsel is defending against these allegations. And it's only during the midst of trial that they start saying we should have named the East Tech Meat Processing Benefit Trust, because that's what we call the fund where we set all this money aside. And it's not a separate entity, so I don't think that they needed to be a party where Rule 93 doesn't apply. This is the exact case where Rule 93 applies.
Could you explain why the trial court rendered a judgment against the plan for $250,000 when it looks like principal sum is $15,000? I don't understand the discrepancy.
The entire plan is not, that is just the cover sheet. Yeah, right. That's not the cover, that's just the cover sheet to show that this is what it is, and we're setting up a little fund on the side by depositing money in it. No, it goes on through that if you're totally disabled, then that would be your benefit. So I don't think anybody's ever contested that. They just contested the fact that that wasn't an issue with the court, because I am, Warner was not sued in the proper capacity. Again, I do believe she was for the court. I don't think it serves any purpose for us to go through a trial again and try these things and put a label on a party that's quite frankly non-existent when all these issues have been tried. I mean, I believe in the second case there's going to be every type of collateral estoppel, judicial estoppel, equitable estoppel applied if we do have to do that. But there's quite frankly not. It's not a party. It's just a fund that they set up. And she's a third-party beneficiary to that fund. They said if you get jury findings on jury questions 1 and 2, then that kicks in the plan. Those references are made by the defense counsel in the record. So there's no reason that the court appeals decision affirming that portion of the judgment should not be affirmed. They failed to comply with Rule 93-2, and therefore that portion of the judgment should be affirmed. With respect to the negligent findings against East Tech, clearly there's tons of evidence in there that they were negligent. They didn't have a competent supervisor there. They didn't have an adequate crew. The crew was going to be 3. If the women did the lifting, it was to help out. There's no evidence that these 2 girls were going to do all the lifting. And this isn't a thing that, well, women can't do the lifting. These 2 women weren't hired to do the lifting. So I think that there's plenty of evidence showing the negligence of Carlo that should be imputed to East Tech so as this court can affirm that portion of the judgment. And with respect to Carlo Warner's liability, he has misfeasance on his part. It's not merely non-feasance. If I have a daycare center and I incorporate myself, but I take kids that I'm caring for out by the pool, and I decide I want to have a beer, and then I decide I want to have 10 more and leave, and the kids drown while I'm gone, is that going to absolve me from liability because I wasn't there? No. Any court would enter a judgment against that incorporated daycare center and that person who put in motion the dangerous condition. And he created a dangerous condition when he had charge and control of the environment. And he decided that it was more important to him to go home and drink and watch TV and not tell these people how to complete their job. For those reasons, we request the court affirm the judgment in all respects and deny all points for the parents.
One last question. Do you agree with Mr. Harris that had they preserved the double recovery issue, that the benefits available under the benefit plan should be applied as a credit to the negligence judgment?
No, sir, I don't, because those are 2 separate harms. Like I said, it's just like her having a private insurance policy. She's entitled to get those benefits and entitled to recover from the court fees.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. First, Justice Corner, to answer your question, I think I see what you're asking now. My reading of this opinion would be there would be a reversal as to I am Warner trustee and an affirmance as to the rest of the case. I've seen some per curiams where the court will grant and reverse part of the case and deny the rest of the application or deny another, but I would take the position that the writ history on this from the Court of Appeals decision would be reversed in part, affirmed in part, because it did outright affirm as to the other 2 parties. Just because Carlo Warner was at work and then left doesn't make any difference in this case. Had he decided to stay home that morning and get drunk, had he decided to stay home that morning and watch TV, or as happened in this case, he came into work, began drinking, and his wife took him home. Doesn't make any difference. He wasn't at work. That is the issue that we're looking at.
Earlier you said that a fellow employee had never been held liable. Do you want to qualify that?
I'm not aware of a decision, Your Honor.
Where a fellow employee has been held liable?
I'm sorry, no, Your Honor, not for not being at work. I'm not aware of any such decision.
And in what circumstances can they be held liable?
For example, where I injure my coworker through an intentional tort, for example. If I'm working at a grocery store as a sacker and I slap someone, or I take a buggy and I run into the person, I could, of course, be held liable to them. But not for me simply not being at work. If I'm a laborer and two of us are doing a job and I decide I want to call in sick that day and I'm not really sick, I can't be individually liable for just not coming into work that day. Now, that might have left an inadequate workforce that my employer needed to take care of.
How about just outright negligence?
If it was, but the negligence has to have causation.
I'm saying.
Yes, Your
Honor. Not these facts, particularly. If a fellow employee negligently goes through a red line.
Out of the workers' comp situation, yes, I believe that would allow liability. Or in the grocery store situation, if the person is negligent in running through the store with a grocery cart and runs into another employee.
Well, they've cited a number of cases of fellow employees being held liable outside the comp situation.
Yes.
And those are correct sites, I think.
Yes.
Does it make any difference that this man was a supervisor?
No, Your Honor. I have not found any distinction in the cases. It might make a difference as to the employer because the supervisor has a little more control over the workplace and might have the duty to instruct someone to do something. So it might impute a higher degree back to the employer, but not as to the employee. It's going to be the same duty. It's a duty of ordinary reasonable care that you owe in a general situation.
I mean, if you're responsible for directing somebody and you're not there, and they have to make it up on their own, that does seem somewhat different than just you're the co-worker that takes the powder.
I haven't found any discussion of that in any of the cases.
There's not a lot of case law.
Yes, Your Honor. It's a matter of, it goes back into the doctrine of respondeat superior. There's going to be the employer that has the duty to provide adequate instructions, for example, the duty to provide an adequate number of workers, and that's where the liability will flow back to. There will be liability in the case, but it will go back to the employer, not to the employee individually. We also heard about the failure to provide a safe workplace. Clearly, there is such a duty on all employers. We heard Ms. Colwell's counsel talk about three things: the crew, the tools, and the instructions. Those are typically three elements that are necessary in providing a reasonably safe workplace. However, in this case, there is no evidence of any tools that should have been provided. There's no evidence whether tools were provided, whether tools were not provided. There's no evidence whether instructions should have been provided, or whether they were provided, or whether they were not provided.
Any testimony about back braces that are usually provided to people that do some heavy lifting?
None whatsoever, Your Honor. There was no expert testimony as to what should have been done in this workplace, as to what was adequate, what was inadequate. That evidence simply did not get put on trial. There was no such evidence. Going back to the crew, this left two workers. It's true that Carlo Werner was at work that morning and went home, but he still left two workers, which was an adequate workforce. There is no evidence in the record that these two meat wrappers constituted an inadequate workforce to do this job.
Was this a routine part of their employment? Is this what they were hired to do?
There was testimony that they all worked together. The evidence...
The fact finder didn't go with you on that, though, did he?
The fact finder simply found that there was negligence. In our position, there is no evidence of that negligence.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and the final clause for the day, and all the foregoing clauses are presented on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.